descended in volume to a sweet murmur. Antonio Heredia Celestino appeared in an open window superimposed on Dred's vision, his shaved head hovering above the dark Caribbean as if he were treading water. Dred would have preferred that Celestino actually were treading water.
Yes. I am sorry to disturb you, Jefe. I hope you have been having a pleasant evening.
What do you want, Celestino? The man's attention to meaningless formalities was one of the things that did not sit well with Dred. He was a more than competent gearman. The Baenas would not hire technical people who were second-rate. But his plodding humorlessness was annoying in itself, as well as evidence of a lack of imagination.
I am having a few doubts about the data tap. The defenses are complicated, and there is a risk that the preliminary work itself may have consequences.
What are you talking about? Celestino bobbed his head nervously and tried to form a winning smile. Dred, a child of the ugliest tin-siding towns of the Australian outback, was torn between disgust and amusement. If the man had a forelock, Dred decided, he would have tugged it.
I fear that these preliminary inspections, the preparation work, well, I fear that they may alert the designate.
The designate? Do you mean the target? What in hell are you trying to say, Celestino? His anger building, Dred turned the madrigal off completely. Have you compromised the action somehow? Are you calling me to say that, oops, you've accidentally scorched our mission?
No, no, please, Jefe, I have done nothing.
The man seemed more alarmed by Dred's sudden fury than by the implication of his incompetence.
No, that is why I wish to talk to you, sir. I would do nothing to risk our security without consulting you.
He hurriedly outlined a series of concerns, most of which Dred found laughably exaggerated. Dred decided, to his great irritation, that what was going on was simple. Celestino had never cracked a system this tough or this complicated, and he wanted to make sure that if anything went wrong, he would have the excuse that he was following orders. The idiot seems to think that just because he's in an apartment a few miles away from the exercise, he'd live through the failure of this action. He obviously doesn't know the old man. So, what are you saying, Celestino? I've been listening for a long time, and I haven't heard anything new.
I wished only to suggest...
He obviously found this too forward.
I wondered if you had considered a narrow-definition data bomb. We could introduce a hunter-killer into the system and immobilize their entire household net. If we properly code our own equip...
Stop. Dred closed his eyes, struggling to remain calm. Maddeningly, Celestino's pinch-faced image still haunted the blackness behind his eyelids. Remind me, didn't you spend time in the military?
B.I.M., said Celestino with a touch of pride. Brigada de Institutos Militares. 4 years.
Of course. Do you know when this operation begins? Do you know anything? We are less than 18 hours away, and you come to me with this kind of shit. Data bomb? Of course you were in the military. If you're not sure about something, blow it up. He scowled horribly, forgetting for a moment that Celestino, for security's sake, was only seeing a low-grade and largely expressionless Dred Sim. You miserable little poofter! What do you think we're going in for? Just to kill someone? If you had been a foot soldier, or a door opener, or even the goddamn janitor, you might have an excuse for thinking that. But you are the Christ-save-us gear man! We are going to freeze and strip the entire system and any remote attachments. Data bomb. What if the thing's programmed to dump everything under assault?
But surely...
The sweat on the hacker's brow was clearly visible. Listen carefully. If we lose one particle of that data, anything... I am going to personally rip your heart out of your body and show it to you. Understand? Celestino nodded, swallowing hard.
Dredd cut the connection, then began to search through his files for music that might salvage his good mood.
That man has a crack in him a mile wide.
The shapeless Sim that was the Baina on the left leaned forward slightly. He is very good at his job.
He's a nervous small-timer. I'm flying someone in to keep an eye on things. No arguments. I'm doing you the courtesy of letting you know.
There was a long silence. It is your choice, one of them said at last.
It is. Damn.
The red light was blinking again, but this time in a recognizable rhythm.
Excuse me. I have to take a call.
The two sisters nodded and blinked off. They were replaced by one of the old man's functionaries, a puppet, as far as Dredd could tell, dressed in the usual costume bazaar Egyptian.
The Lord of Life and Death, mighty in worship, who is crowned in the West, summons you to the presence.
Dredd suppressed a groan.
Now? Can't he just talk to me?
The functionary did not bat an eye.
You are summoned to Abydos,
it said, then vanished. Dredd sat for a long moment just breathing, then stood and stretched to release tension. It might prove a very painful mistake to take his frustration and anger to the old man, and looked with more than a little sorrow at the cigar, which was now mostly gray char in the bottom of the ceramic bowl he had been using as an ashtray. He sat down again and found a comfortable position, since the old man's caprice often extended to hour-long waits, and closed his eyes. The massive hypostyle hall of Abydos that was stretched before him, the swollen skyscraper pillars made even more dramatic by the light of innumerable flickering lamps. He could see the god's chair on the dais at the far end of the hall, looming above the bent backs of 1,000 priests like a volcanic island rising from the ocean. Dredd grunted in disgust and made his way forward, even though he could not actually feel the jackaleers above his head or see the cur's muzzle he wore, even though the priests kept their faces to the floor as they made way for him, and not a single one even stole a glance at him, he felt angry and humiliated. The action would begin in mere hours, but would the old man cut through some of his ridiculous ceremony and make things a little easier? Of course he wouldn't. Dredd was his dog, summoned to hear his master's voice, and would never be allowed to forget it. As he reached the front of the hall and lowered himself to all fours in front of the throne, he harbored a brief but satisfying fantasy of putting a match to the old bastard's mummy wrappings.
"Arise, my servant."
Dredd stood. Even had he been standing on the dais, he would have been dwarfed by the figure of his employer.
Always has to remind me who's on top.
Tell me of the Sky God project.
Dredd took a breath, suppressing his fury, and delivered a status report on the final preparations. Osiris, the Lord of Life and Death, listened with apparent interest, but although his corpse-like face was as immobile as ever, Dredd thought the old man seemed vaguely distracted. His bandaged fingers moved ever so slightly on the arms of his throne, and once he asked Dredd to repeat something that should have been perfectly comprehensible the first time.
"The responsibility for this idiot programmer is yours," Osiris pronounced when told about Celestino's call. "Take steps to make sure this is not a weak link in our chain."
Dredd bristled at the assumption that he had to be told. With effort, he managed to keep his voice even.
"A professional with whom I have already worked is on her way down. She will watch over Celestino."
Osiris waved his hand as though this were all perfectly obvious.
"This must not fail. I have placed great trust in you, despite your many lapses of behavior. This must not fail."
Despite his own simmering unhappiness, Dredd was intrigued. The old man appeared to be worried, if not about this, then about something else.
"When have I ever failed you, grandfather?"
"Don't call me that."
Osiris lifted his arms from the throne and crossed them over his chest.
"I have told you before I will not allow it from a mere servant."
Dredd barely restrained a hiss of rage. No, let the old bastard say what he wished. There was a longer game. The old man himself had taught him to play it, and this might be the first crack in his master's defenses.
I apologize, O Lord. All will be done as you say.
He lowered his great black head, bumping his muzzle gently against the stone flags.
Have I done something new to make you angry?
He wondered briefly if the stewardess... No, her body couldn't even have been found yet, and for once he had refrained from leaving his signature. Art shackled by necessity, the god of Upper and Lower Egypt, tilted his head down. For a moment, Dredd thought he could see the fierce intelligence glinting in the depths of the old man's eyes.
No, he said at last, you have done nothing. I am overquick in my anger, perhaps. I am very busy, and much of the business is unpleasant.
I'm afraid I probably would not understand your problems, my lord. Just managing a project like the one you've given me takes everything I've got. I can't imagine the complexity of what you must deal with.
Osiris sat back in his great throne, staring out across the hall.
No, you cannot. At this very moment, this moment, my enemies are assembling in my council chamber. I must confront them. There is a plot against me, and I do not yet.
He trailed off, then twitched his huge head and leaned forward.
Has anyone approached you? Have you been asked about me, offered anything for information or assistance? I promise you, as terrible as my anger will be at anyone who betrays me, my generosity to my faithful servants is even greater.
Dredd sat in silence for a long second, afraid to speak too swiftly. The old devil had never talked this openly before, never shown worry or vulnerability in front of him. He wished there was some way he could record the moment for later study, but instead he must commit every word and gesture to his own frail human memory.
No one has approached me, Lord. I promise I would have told you immediately. But if there is something I can do to help you, information you need gathered, allies you are not sure of that you want to—
No, no, no!
Osiris waved his flail impatiently, silencing his servant.
I will deal with it, as I always have. You will do your part by making sure that the Sky God project goes as planned.
Of course, Lord.
Go. I will speak to you again before the action is launched. Find someone to keep a close eye on that programmer.
Yes, Lord.
The god waved his crook, and Dredd was expelled from the system. He remained in the chair for a long time, ignoring three different incoming calls while he thought about what he had just seen and heard. At last he stood up. Downstairs the cleaning team had finished their prep and were climbing into their van. Dredd flicked the cigar end off the balcony into the dark water, then went back into the house.
Look, we just have to tie the ends one more time, then we're done.
Fredericks held up a handful of serpentine creepers and vines.
Those are waves out there, Orlando. And God only knows what else there is. Sharks. Sea monsters, maybe. Come on. A little extra trouble now will make a big difference when we're on the water.
Orlando looked down at the raft. It was a decent enough job. Lengths of stiff, heavy reeds knotted together in long bundles, which had then been tied together to make one long rectangle. It would probably even float. He was just finding it hard to care very much. I need to sit down for a minute. He stumbled to the shade of the nearest palm tree and flopped to the sand.
Fine, I'll do it. What else is new?
Fredericks bent to the task. Orlando lifted a trembling hand to shade his eyes from the sun filtering down between the palm leaves. The city was different at noon. It changed throughout the day, colors and reflective metals mutating with the movement of light, shadows expanding and contracting. Just now it seemed a kind of giant mushroom patch, golden roofs springing from the loamy soil of their own shade. He let his hand fall and leaned back against the palm trunk. He was very, very weak. It was easy to imagine burying himself in sand, like the roots of a tree, and never moving again. He was exhausted and sluggish because of his illness, and he could not conceive of how he would make it through another night like the last, a night of confusions and terrors and madness, none of it comprehensible, and none of it in the least restful.
Okay. I've double-tied everything. Are you at least going to help me carry it down to the water?
Orlando stared at him for a long time, but still Frederick's pink, unhappy face refused to disappear. He groaned. Coming, the raft did float, although parts of it remained resolutely below the waterline, so that there was nowhere dry to sit. Still, the warm weather did not make that too uncomfortable. Orlando was glad at least that he had prevailed on Fredericks to bring the wall of the palm leaf shelter along, no matter how short a trip his friend expected. Orlando tilted it over them, letting it lean against his shoulders. It kept off the worst of the afternoon sun, but it did little to cool the heat in his head and his joints.
"I don't feel very good," he said quietly. "I told you I've got pneumonia."
It was about the only conversation he had to offer, but even he was growing tired of it. Fredericks, splashing obdurately with a makeshift paddle, did not reply. Astonishingly, to Orlando anyway, they were actually making a kind of slow progress toward the city. The cross-current was bearing them unmistakably to what Orlando guessed was the northern side of the shoreline, but the drift was slight. He thought they might very well make it to the far side before the current pulled them out into what were probably ocean waters. And if they didn't, well, Fredericks would be disappointed. But Orlando was having trouble seeing what the difference would be. He was adrift in some kind of limbo, his strength leaking away hourly, and what he had left behind, in what he still quaintly thought about from time to time as the real world, was no better.
"I know you're sick. But could you try to paddle for a little while?"
Fredericks was working hard not to be resentful. As if from a distance, Orlando admired him/her for it.
"My arms are really aching, but if we don't keep pushing, the current will take us away from the beach."
It was a tough call as to which would take more energy, arguing or paddling. Orlando went to work. His arms felt as flabby and weak as noodles. But there was a certain soothing quality to the repetition of dipping his paddle, pulling, raising it, then dipping it again. After a while, the monotony combined with the sun's rippling reflections and his fevered driftiness to lift him into a kind of reverie, so he didn't notice the water rising until Fredericks shouted out that they were sinking. Alerted, but still buffered by his dreamy detachment, Orlando looked down at the water, which was now up to the crotch of his loincloth. The middle of the raft had descended, or the sides had risen. In either case, most of the craft was now at least partially underneath the water.
"What do we do?"
Frederick sounded like someone who believed that things mattered. "Do? Sink, I guess."
"Are you scanning out, Gardner?"
Clearly fighting back panic, Fredericks looked up at the horizon.
"We might be able to swim the rest of the way."
Orlando followed his gaze, then laughed.
"Are you scanned? I can barely paddle."
He looked at the length of split reed in his hand.
"Not that it's doing us any good now."
He tossed the paddle away. It splashed into the water and then popped up again, bobbing along far more convincingly than the raft. Fredericks shouted in horror and stretched toward it, as though he could reverse physics and draw it back through the air.
"I can't believe you just did that!"
He looked down at the raft again, full of twitchy, terrified energy.
"I have an idea. We'll get in the water, but we'll use the raft as a float. You know, like those rafts in swimming class."
End of side 21. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 22. City of Golden Shadow. Other Land, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 682. Orlando had never been in a swimming class, or anything that his mother feared might be dangerous to his fragile bones. But he was not disposed to argue anyway. At his friend's urging, he slid off the raft into the cool water. Fredericks splashed in beside him, then braced his chest against the trailing edge of the raft and began to kick in a manner that was a credit to his long-ago instructors.
"Can't you kick, too? At least a little?"
he panted.
"I am kicking,"
Orlando said.
"Whatever happened?"
Fredericks gasped.
"To all that Thargor strength, all that monster-ass-kicking muscle. Come on!"
It was an effort even to explain, and frequent mouthfuls of salt water didn't help.
"I'm sick, Federico, and maybe the gain isn't turned up as high on this system. I always had to crank the tactor outputs way up to make it work as well as it did for someone normal.
They had only dog-paddled for a few minutes when Orlando felt his strength finally desert him. His legs slowed, then stopped. He hung on to the back of the raft, but even that was difficult.
"Orlando, I need your help!"
The city, which once had waited squarely before them, had now shifted to the right. The blue water between the raft and the beach, however, had not narrowed appreciably. They were drifting out to sea, Orlando realized, as he himself was drifting. They would get farther and farther from land, until eventually the city would disappear entirely. But that's not fair. The thought seemed to come in slow bumps, like the waves. Fredericks wants to live. He wants to play soccer and do things. Wants to be a real boy, just like Pinocchio. I'm just holding him back. I'm the Donkey Island kid.
Orlando?
No, not fair. He has to paddle hard enough to pull my weight, too. Not fair. He let go and slid under the water. It was surprisingly easy. The surface snapped shut over him like an eyelid closing, and for a moment he felt complete weightlessness, complete ease, and a certain dull smugness at his decision. Then something seized his hair, jerking him into fiery pain and a throat full of seawater. He was pulled to the surface, spluttering.
"Orlando!" Frederick shrieked. "What the hell are you doing?"
He was clinging to the raft with one hand so he could maintain his grip on Thargor's long black hair. "Now nobody's kicking," Orlando thought sadly. He spat out salty water and barely avoided a coughing spasm. "It isn't doing any good at all. I just can't go any farther," he said aloud.
"Grab the raft,"
Fredericks directed.
"Grab the raft!"
Orlando did, but Fredericks didn't relinquish his grip. For a moment they just floated, side by side. The raft rose and fell as the waves moved past. Except for the stinging pain in his scalp, nothing had changed. Fredericks, too, had gotten a mouthful of seawater. His nose was running, his eyes red-rimmed.
"You aren't going to quit! You're not going to!"
Orlando found enough strength to shake his head.
"I can't..." "Can't? You impacted bastard! You've made my life a living hell about this stupid goddamn city! And there it is! And you're just going to give up?"
"I'm sick."
"So what?" "Yeah, yeah, it's really sad. You've got some weird disease, but that's the place you wanted to go. You've dreamed about it. It's the only thing you care about, practically. So either you're going to help me get to that beach, or I'm going to have to drag you like I learned in that stupid swimming class. And then we'll both drown, 500 yards away from your goddamn city. You goddamn coward!"
Fredericks was breathing so hard he could barely finish his sentence. He clung to the bobbing raft, neck deep in the water, and glared. Orlando was faintly amused that anyone could muster so much emotion about a pointless thing like the difference between going on and going down. But he also felt a slight irritation that Fredericks, should be calling him a coward.
"You want me to help you? Is that what you're saying?" "No. I want you to do what was so important that you got me into this impacted fen-fen mess in the first place."
Again, it had become easier to paddle than to argue. Also, Fredericks was still gripping his hair, and Orlando's head was bent at an uncomfortable angle.
"Okay, just let go." "No tricks?"
Orlando wearily shook his head. "You try to do a guy a favor." They edged forward until their chests were back on the raft and began kicking again. The sun was very low in the sky, and a cool wind was making the tips of the waves froth when they made it past the first breakwater and out of the cross-current. After a short celebratory rest, Fredericks let Orlando climb up onto the bowed raft and paddle with his hands while Fredericks continued his outboard motor impersonation. By the time they reached the second breakwater, they were no longer alone, but merely the smallest of the waterway's travelers. Other boats, some clearly equipped with engines, others with full-bellied sails, were beginning to make their way back from a day's work. The wakes of their passing made the raft rock alarmingly. Orlando climbed back into the water. Above them and around them, the city was beginning to turn on its lights. They were debating whether or not to try to signal one of the passing boats, when Orlando began to feel another wash of fever pass over him.
"We can't try to take this raft all the way in,"
Fredericks was arguing.
Some big ship will come through here, and they won't even see us in the dark.
I think all the big ships come in the other side, Orlando said.
He was finding it hard to get enough breath to speak.
Look,
on the far side of the harbor maze, beyond several jetties, two large vessels, one of them a tanker of some sort, were being hauled into the port by tugboats. Nearer, vastly smaller than the tanker, but still fairly large and impressive, was a barge. Despite his exhaustion, Orlando couldn't help staring at it. The barge, covered in painted carvings, and with something that looked like a sun with an eye in it painted on the bow, seemed to belong to a different age than the harbor's other ships. It had a single tall mast and a flat, square sail. Lanterns hung in the rigging and at the bow. As Orlando stared at this strange apparition, the world seemed to pass into some greater shadow. Lanterns flared into blurry star shapes. He had a moment to wonder how twilight had become dark midnight so suddenly, and to feel sad that the city's residents had doused all their lights. Then he felt the water slide up and over him again. This time, Orlando barely felt it when Fredericks pulled him out. The fever had gripped him again, and he was so exhausted that he could not imagine it ever letting go. A distant foghorn had become a smear of sound that rang in his ears, fading, but never completely stopping. Fredericks was saying something urgent, but Orlando could not make sense of it. Then a light, as bright as anything Orlando could imagine, replaced the darkness with a whiteness far more painful and terrible. The spotlight belonged to a small boat. The small boat belonged to the harbor police of the great city. They were not cruel, but they were briskly uninterested in what Fredericks had to say. It seemed that they were on the lookout for outsiders, and the two men treading water beside a handmade raft seemed to fit the description. As they hauled Orlando and Fredericks on board, they talked among themselves. Orlando heard the words God King and Council. It seemed that he and Fredericks were being arrested for some kind of crime, but he was finding it harder and harder to make sense out of what was happening around him. The barge loomed above them. Then the carved hull began to slide by as the patrol boat motored past it on the way to the dock of the Great Palace. But before they had reached the hull's far end, consciousness escaped Orlando's grasp. Chapter 35 Lord of Temeloon. Netfeed News. Vat beef poisoning scare in Britain. Visual. Mob outside Derbyshire factory. V.O. A rash of fatal illnesses in Britain has caused chaos in the cultured meat industry. One food product company, Artiflesh Limited, has seen drivers attacked and a factory burned to the ground. Visual. Salmonella bacteria under microscopic enlargement. The deaths are blamed on a salmonella infection of a beef mother, the original flesh matrix from which up to 100 generations of vat-grown meat can be derived. One such mother can be the source of thousands of tons of cultured meat.
Otasco!
Rini raised her hands to defend herself, but their captor only regarded her with faint irritation.
You know my name? I am surprised.
Why? Because we're just little people?
Confronted with the first real face, as real as any sim face could be, behind Otherland, she found she was not frightened. A cold anger filled her, and made her feel she was standing apart from herself.
No.
Otasco seemed genuinely puzzled.
Because I did not think my name was commonly known. At least outside of certain circles. Who are you?
Rini reached out and touched Khabu on the shoulder. As much for her own comfort as his.
If you don't know, I'm certainly not going to tell you.
The God King shook his head.
You are a most impertinent young woman.
Rini?
Martine began, but at that moment something slithered at high speed across the floor of the council chamber, an iridescent blur that skirted Rini and Khabu by a matter of inches before disappearing into the shadows.
Ah!
As he followed the odd apparition with his gaze, the annoyance faded from Bolivar Otasco's face.
There it is again. Do you know what that is?
Rini could not gauge his tone.
No. What?
He shook his head.
I haven't the slightest idea.
Well, that is not exactly true.
I have an idea of what it represents, but not what it is. It's a phenomenon of complexity. the immense complexity of the system. Not the first, and I dare say not the last or the strangest. He stood for a moment, pondering, then turned back to Rini and her friends. Perhaps we should cut this unsatisfying conversation short. There is still much to do.
Torture?
Rini knew she should keep quiet, but months of frustration and rage could not be ignored. She felt hardened and sharpened like a knife blade.
Firebombing people's apartments, and putting children into comas, and beating old women to death not satisfying enough?
Rini, Martine began again, but was interrupted by Atasco's angry shout.
Enough!
His eyes had narrowed to slits.
Are you a madwoman? Who are you to come into my world and make such accusations?
He turned to Martine.
Are you her caretaker? If so, you have failed. The monkey has better manners.
The monkey is perhaps more patient, Martine said quietly.
Rini, Habu, I think we may have made a mistake.
A mistake? Rini was astonished. Perhaps Martine had developed some kind of amnesia because of her traumatic entry into the Simworld. But she herself remembered Atasco's name only too well. In any case, she had only to look at the arrogant, aristocratic face that he had chosen to know everything about him.
I don't think there's any mistake except him thinking that we'll be polite about this.
Habu clambered up onto one of the chairs, and from there onto the surface of the vast table.
A question, Mr. Atasco. Why did you bring us here?
He took in the talking monkey without comment.
I did not bring you here. You brought yourselves here, I would assume.
But why?
Habu persisted.
You are the ruler of this fantastical place. Why are you spending time speaking to us? What do you think that we want?
Atasco raised an eyebrow.
You have been summoned here. I have let the person who summoned you use my city, my palace, for the sake of convenience. Well, and because I share some of his fears.
He shook his head as though it were all quite obvious. His high, feathered crown swayed.
Why am I speaking to you? You are guests. It is courtesy, of course. Something you seem able to do without.
Are you saying...
Weenie had to stop for a moment to figure out just what he was saying.
Are you saying that you haven't brought us here to hurt us or threaten us? That you don't have anything to do with my brother being in a coma? With the people who killed Dr. Susan Von Blake?
Atasco stared at her for a long moment. The handsome face was still imperially condescending, but she could sense a certain hesitation.
If the terrible acts you describe can be laid at the doorstep of the Grail Brotherhood, then I am not entirely without blame,
he said at last.
It is because I fear I may have unwittingly contributed to that evil that I have made my beloved Temelun available as a gathering place. But I am not personally responsible for the things you suggest. For the love of God, no.
He turned to look across the broad room.
Lord, these are odd times. Few strangers ever come here. And now there will be many. But this is a time of change, I suppose.
He turned back.
Do you know what tomorrow is? Four movement. We inherited our dates from the Aztecs, you see. But that is a very significant day. The end of the fifth sun. The end of an age. Most of my people have forgotten the old superstitions, but of course that's because it's been 1,000 years in their time.
Is he crazy? Rini wondered. I'm talking about people killed and crippled. He's talking about Aztec calendars.
But you said we were summoned.
Habu spread his long arms.
Please, summoned by whom?
You must wait for the others. I am the host, but I am not the one who has chosen you.
Rini felt as though the world had abruptly reversed its spin. Were they just going to take this man's word for it, that he was somehow on their side? If that were true, why all this vagueness? She picked at the knot, but could see no immediate solution.
So that's all you can tell us, even though you're the big chief around here?
She asked at last, earning a reproachful stare from Habu. Atasco had not conquered his initial dislike, but he made an effort to answer her civilly.
The one who called you has labored long and with great subtlety. Even I do not know everything he has done or thought. Rini frowned. She was not going to be able to make herself like the man. That seemed certain. He reminded her of some of the worst South African whites, the rich ones, subtle, secretive heirs of the Ancien Régime, who never had to assert their superiority because they just assumed it was obvious. But she had to admit to herself that she might have misjudged him.
"Okay, if I've been too quick to accuse, I apologize," she said. "Please understand. After the attacks we've survived, and then to find ourselves in this place, manhandled by police..."
"Manhandled? Is this true?" She shrugged.
"Not violently, but they certainly didn't make us think we were honored guests, either."
"I will pass them a word. Gently, of course. They must have autonomy. If the God King speaks too harshly, the whole system becomes perturbed."
Martine had been looking as though she wished to speak for some time.
"You have built this place, no? It is yours?" "Grown it would perhaps be closer to the mark."
His chilly expression softened.
"You came in by bus, I understand."
"That is too bad.
You did not see the splendid canals or the harbor. Would you like me to tell you something about Temelun?"
"Yes, very much," Martine said hurriedly. "But first, something else. I am having trouble filtering my input. The raw data is very strong. Could you... is there a way you could adjust it? I am afraid it is rather too much for me."
"I should think so."
He paused, but it was more than a pause. His body simply froze in place, with none of the small signs that a living but still human body shows. Khabu looked at Rini, who shrugged. She did not know what Atasco was doing, and wasn't quite sure what Martine was talking about either. Then, with no warning, Atasco's sim was alive again.
"It can be done, I believe," he said, "but not easily. You are receiving the same quantity of information as the others, and since you are all on the same line, I cannot change yours without lowering their input as well."
He paused, then shook his head.
"We must find some way to bring you back on a different line. You should not do it, though, until you have spoken to Sellers. I do not know what he plans for you, and you might not be able to enter the network again in time."
"Sellers?"
Rini tried to keep her voice calm. This man obviously preferred his conversations politely formal.
"Is he the one who summoned us, as you said?"
"Yes. You will meet him soon, when the others arrive."
"Others? What—"
Martine cut her off.
"I will not enter the network again. Not if it means I must pass through the security system."
Atasco inclined his head.
"I could bring you in as my guest, of course. I could have brought you all in as my guests, and offered to do so. But Sellers was violently opposed to anything like that. It was something about the security system. You must speak to him about it, since I do not quite understand."
"What was that thing?"
Rini asked.
"That so-called security system killed our friend."
For the first time, Atasco seemed truly shocked.
"What? What do you mean?"
Rini, with interpolations from Khabu and Martine, told him what had happened. By the time she was finished, Atasco had begun to pace.
"This is dreadful. Are you sure? Could he not simply have had an attack of the heart?"
Under stress, his English was a little more heavily accented, a little less precise.
"It had us all,"
Rini said evenly.
"Singh said that it was alive, and I don't know how else you could describe it. What is it?"
"It is the neural network, the thing that underlies the Grail network system. It was grown as the simulations were grown, I believe. I do not know much about it. That was not my role, but it was not meant to." "That is terrible. If what you say is true, then Sellers is not a moment too soon."
"My God."
"Terrible. Terrible."
Atasco had stopped pacing, and now looked agitatedly around him.
"You must hear what he says. I will only confuse things. It seems he is right, though. We have lived in our own isolated world too long."
"Tell us about this place you have grown,"
said Martine. Rini was irritated. She wanted to hear more about this mysterious Sellers, about the thing that Khabu had named the All-Devourer, but it seemed Martine preferred a hobby lecture from a rich crank. She looked to Habu for support, but he was giving Atasco a soulful and attentive look, particularly galling on the face of a baboon. She made a quiet noise of disgust.
Teneloon?
Their host brightened a little.
Of course. You came from Arakataka, no?
Down from the forests.
What did you think of the people you saw?
Were they happy? Well fed?
Weenie shrugged.
Yes, seemed to be.
And not a word of Spanish.
No priests.
Well, a few these days from overseas, but they have trouble finding people to come to their strange and unfamiliar churches.
But no Catholicism to speak of.
And all because of horses.
Weenie looked at Habu, who also looked confused.
Horses?
She asked.
Oh, it is most elementary, my dear.
What is your name?
Weenie hesitated.
In for a penny, in for a pound,
she decided. If he's faking this whole thing, these people are even farther out of our league than we guessed. And if the Grail Brotherhood could burn down her flat block and freeze Jeremiah's cred cards, her name wouldn't be news to anyone.
Irene Sulawayo.
Weenie.
Elementary, my dear Irene.
Warming to what was obviously a favorite subject, Atasco seemed to have totally forgotten his earlier antipathy.
Horses, the one thing the Americas lacked.
You see, the ancestral horse died out here.
Well, in the here that is my real life home, but not in the world of Temeloon. When the great empires of the Americas arose in the real world, the Toltec, Aztec, Mayan, Inca, our own Muisca, they had several handicaps the civilizations of the Tigris Valley or the Mediterranean did not have. Slower communications. No large wagons or sledges, since there were no animals capable of hauling them. Less need for broad, flat roads. Hence, less pressure to develop the wheel, and so on.
He began pacing again, but this time with an air of happy energy.
In the real world, the Spanish came to the Americas and discovered them ripe for plucking. Only a few hundred men with guns and horses subjugated two continents. Think of that. So I built America again. But this time, the horse did not die out.
He took off his feathered crown and set it on the table.
Everything was different here. In my invented world, Aztecs and others developed much broader empires, and after receiving trading visits from ancient Phoenicia, began reaching out down the sea roads to other civilizations. When gunpowder came from Asia into Western Europe and the Middle East, the boats of the Tlatoani, the Aztec emperor, if you will, brought it back to the Americas as well.
But these people have cellular phones!
Against her better judgment, Weenie found herself drawn into Atasco's fantasy.
How many years old is this civilization?
This simulation is now only a little behind the real world. If there were an actual Europe on the far side of the ocean outside this palace, it would be experiencing the early part of the 21st century. But Christ and the Western calendar never came here. So even though the Aztec Empire fell long ago, we still call this day Four Movement, the Fifth Sun.
He smiled with childlike pleasure.
But that's what I don't understand. How could you have started back in the Ice Age or whatever, and now be in the present day? Are you trying to tell me you've been watching this thing for like 10,000 years?
Ah, I see. Yes, I have.
Another self-satisfied smile.
But not all at regular speed. There is a macro level where the centuries hurry past, and I can only gather data in large, general clumps. But when I wish to really understand something, I can slow the simulation down to normal speed, or even stop it.
You play God, in other words.
But how could you create every one of these people?
Habu asked.
Surely each one would take a long time.
He sounded quite convincingly interested. Weenie at first thought he might be trying to prevent her from further antagonizing their host. But then she remembered the Bushman's own cherished goal. You do not create separate individuals in a system like this, said Temeloon's God King. Not one at a time, anyway. This simulation,
and all the others in this entire network are grown. The units of life begin as simple automata, organisms with very basic rules. But the more they are allowed to interact, adapt, and evolve, the more complex they become. His gesture encompassed himself and the other three, as is true with life itself. But when our automata get to a certain level of complexity, we can, as it were, file off the rough edges and have a sort of fractal seed for an artificial plant or animal, or even a human being, which will then grow as its own individual genetics and environment dictate.
That's pretty much what they do already on the net, said Rini. All the big VR setups are based on data ecologies, one way or the other.
Yes, but they do not have the power that we have. He shook his head emphatically. They do not have the potential for complexity, for sophisticated individuality. But you know this now, do you not? You have seen Temelune. Is it not as true, as authentic in its variety, as any place you have visited in the real world? You cannot accomplish that on the net, no matter how much money and effort you put in. The platform will not support it.
Yeah, but the security systems on the net don't kill people either. Otosko's high-boned face flushed with fury, but it lasted for only a moment.
Then a more doleful expression took its place. I cannot defend it. I have spent so long watching the results, I fear I may have overlooked the price being paid.
But what is this place, really? Is it an art project? A science experiment? What?
All of those things, I suppose.
Otosko broke off, staring over their shoulders. Excuse me for a moment. He walked past them around the table. The great doors at the chamber's far end had opened, and the guards were ushering through three more people. Two of them wore female bodies similar to Martine's, dark-complected and black-haired like Temelune's native inhabitants. The other was a very tall figure, dressed from head to foot in extravagant, showy black. Feathers, ruffles, and long, pointed boots gave this newcomer the silhouette of some ancient court dandy. A skull-tight black leather hood covered all the stranger's head, but for a bone-white, sexually ambiguous face with blood-red lips.
Looks like someone out of some horrible Ganga drone band,
Rini decided. Otosko greeted the new arrivals. Before he had finished, the apparition in black ostentatiously detached itself from the rest and sauntered to the room's far wall to examine the murals. Otosko showed the other two to chairs and returned to Rini and her friends.
Temelune is both science and art, I suppose, he continued as though the interruption had not happened. It is my life's work. I have always wondered what my native land would have been like if the Spaniards had not conquered. When I realized that for money, mere money, I could discover the answer, I did not hesitate. I have no children. My wife lives for the same dream.
Have you met her?
Rini shook her head, trying to keep up with him.
Your wife?
No. She is around here somewhere. She is the genius with numbers. I can perceive a pattern, guess at an explanation, but she is the one who will tell me the hard facts. How many bushels of rice have been sold in the Temelune market, or what effect the drought is having on population emigration to the countryside. Rini wanted to go and talk to the other guests, if guests was the right word, but she had belatedly realized that she could also learn things from Otosko, for all his eccentricity.
So you've made an entire world? I wouldn't think there were enough processors in the universe to do that, no matter what kind of fancy new network architecture you had.
He raised his hand, graciously condescending to point out what should have been obvious.
I have not created the entire world. Rather, what exists here,
he spread his arms,
is the center of a greater world that exists only as data. The Aztecs, the Toltecs, they were only information that influenced Temelune in its growth. Although for a while there were real Aztec overlords here.
He shook his head in fond remembrance. Even the Muiscas, who built this city during the height of their empire, largely existed outside the boundaries of the simulation. Their capital and greatest city was at Bogota,
just as in the real world. He seemed to interpret Rini's look of general confusion as something specific. The Muiscas? You may know them as the Chibches, but that is the name of the language group rather than the people. No. He sighed, a potter forced to work with faulty clay. In any case, there are at least 2 million humanoid instruments in the simulation, and the rest of the world in which Timaloon exists is only an extremely complicated system of algorithms without telemorphic representation. He frowned slightly. You said you came from Arakataka, did you not? That, you see, is very close to the northern border of the world, as one might say. Not that you would see the edge of the simulation. It is not so primitive. You would see the water, of course, and some illusion of country beyond. So all this network, this other land, is made up of such places? Martin asked. The dreams and conceits of wealthy men?
Otasco did not appear to take offense.
I suppose, although I have not traveled outside my own domain very often. Not surprising when you consider how much of my blood and sweat I have put into this place. Some of the other domains are, well, I find them personally offensive, but as our homes should be bastions of privacy, so should our worlds. I would be very displeased if someone came here to tell me how to manage Temelun. Rini was watching the stranger in black, who was very pointedly not paying attention to anyone else. Was this someone who had been summoned as she had? Why? What was the point of people being gathered in the irritatingly self-centered Otasco's virtual kingdom? And who in hell was Sellers? Rini's pondering was interrupted by the doors thumping open to admit several more people. One appeared to be under police restraint, for a caped guard stood on either side of him. But after a moment, Rini saw that they were helping him to walk. He was tipped into a chair where he slumped like a sick child. Odd, because he wore the impossibly well-muscled body of an Olympic gymnast. A smaller friend huddled beside him, offering what looked like words of encouragement. These two, and a third who wore a shiny, robotic body, remained when the guards left. Bolivar Otasco left again to greet these latest arrivals. Rini stared at the newcomers. There was something naggingly familiar about the muscular, black-haired Sim. As she turned to consult Khabu, she felt a gentle touch on her arm. One of the previous group of guests, a small, round woman in a Temeluni Sim, stood beside her.
I am sorry to bother you. I am very confused. May I speak with you for a moment?
Rini could not help looking the stranger over. But there was no way to deduce anything certain about anyone in VR.
Of course. Sit down. She led the woman to the chair beside Martine's. I do not understand where I am. That man said we are in his simulation, but I have never seen a simulation like this.
None of us have, Rini assured her. It's a whole new universe when you've got that kind of money, I guess. The newcomer shook her head.
It is all so strange. I have been searching for help for my poor granddaughter, and thought I had discovered a source of information about what had harmed her. I have worked so hard to learn the truth, but now, instead of finding information, I find myself in... I do not know what it is.
Khabu popped up beside her. Is your granddaughter ill? He asked. Is she asleep and will not wake up? The woman drew back. Although Rini thought it was more from the startling suddenness of his question than Khabu's simian form.
Yes, she has been in the hospital for many months. The cleverest specialists in Hong Kong do not know what the problem is.
The same thing is wrong with my brother. Rini described what had happened to Stephen, and how she and her friends had been led to Temelun. The woman listened avidly, making little noises of shock and unhappiness.
I had thought I was the only one, she said. When my little dear one became sick, my flower, I felt sure it was something to do with the net. But my daughter and her husband, I think they believe I have lost my mind, although they are too kind to say so.
Her shoulders trembled. Rini realized she was crying, although the Sim did not show tears.
Forgive me. I have worried that I might indeed be going mad.
She wiped at her eyes.
Oh, I have intruded on you. but have not even told you my name. I am so impolite. My name is Cho'an Li."
Rini introduced herself and her friends. "We're as surprised by all this as you are. We thought we were breaking into our enemy's personal playground. I suppose we did, in a way. But this man Atasco doesn't seem very much like an enemy." She looked over at their host, who was talking to the black-clad stranger.
"Who is that with him? The one with the clown face. Did he come in with you?"
Cho'an Li nodded.
"I do not know him. I am not even sure it is a him."
She giggled, then lifted her hand to her mouth, as though she had shocked herself.
"He was waiting outside when the guards brought us. Me and the other woman sitting there."
She indicated the other, Temaluni Sim.
"I do not know her name, either. We all entered together.
Perhaps he is Sellers," Khabu suggested.
"He is not,"
said Martine distractedly. She was staring at the high ceiling, her eyes still without focus.
"He calls himself Sweet William. He is from England."
Rini realized after a moment that her mouth was open. Even on a Sim, that was not an attractive expression. She shut it.
"How do you know?"
Before Martine could answer, the sound of chairs being scraped against the stone floor made them all turn. Atasco had seated himself at the head of the long table, where he had been joined by a coldly beautiful Temaluni woman dressed in a white cotton dress, her only ornament a magnificent necklace of blue stones. Rini had not seen her enter. She guessed it must be Atasco's number-crunching wife.
"Welcome to the Council Hall of Temaloon."
Atasco spread his arms in benediction as the rest of the guests seated themselves.
"I know you have come from many places, and with many different purposes. I wish I had the leisure to speak with each one of you, but our time is short. Still, I hope you have had at least a brief opportunity to see something of this world. It has much to offer the interested sightseer."
"Oh, for God's sake," Rini murmured. "Get on with it."
Atasco paused as though he had heard her, but his expression was puzzled rather than irritated. He turned and whispered something to his wife, who whispered back.
"I am not sure what to tell you," he said aloud. "The one who summoned you should have been here by now."
The shiny robotic Sim Rini had noted earlier stood. Its excessively intricate armor had razor-sharp points everywhere.
"This far duppy,"
it said in a contemptuous goggle-boy drawl.
"No clock for this. Flying now."
It made a series of gestures with its chrome-gleaming fingers, then seemed taken aback when nothing happened. Before anyone else could say anything, a yellowish light flared brightly beside the Atascos. Several of the guests cried out in surprise. The figure that stood beside Bolivar Atasco when the flash subsided was a featureless humanoid splash of white, as though someone had ripped away the substance of the council chamber. Rini had been one of those who had shouted, but not because of the apparition's startling entrance.
"I've seen that thing before. In a dream? No, in that club. In Mr. J's."
A memory that had been almost lost was coming back. Her last feeble moments in the depths of that horrible club. This thing had helped her? It was all very fuzzy. She turned to Khabu for confirmation, but the bushman was watching the latest arrival with keen interest. Beside him, Martine looked completely overwhelmed, as though she were lost in a dark forest. Even Atasco seemed taken aback by the entrance.
"Ah, it's you, Sellers."
The empty space at the top of the blank turned as it surveyed the room.
"So few,"
it said sadly. Rini felt the hair on her neck lift. She had indeed heard those high, almost feminine tones in the trophy garden at Mr. J's.
"We are so very few,"
it went on.
"Only 12, all told, including our hosts. But I am grateful that any are here at all. You must have many questions."
"We certainly do,"
the one Martine had called Sweet William interrupted loudly. His accent was an impossibly exaggerated, theatrical northern English.
"Like who the friggin' hell are you? And what the friggin' hell is going on here?"
The empty face showed nothing, but Rini thought she heard a smile in the soft voice.
"My name is Sellers, as Mr. Atasco has said. Like many of the rest of you, I am in hiding now, but that name, at least, is no longer a secret I need to keep. As to the rest of your question, young man...
Please! Watch what you call a body, Chuck!
I will do my best to answer it, but it is not something I can do quickly. I ask for your patience.
Asking's not getting,
Sweet William said, but waved for Sellers to continue. Habu, perhaps seeking a better vantage point, climbed up out of his chair and crouched on the tabletop beside Rini.
I am something of an expert on the movement of data from place to place,
Sellers began.
Many people examine data for particular purposes. Financial market data to make money, meteorological data to predict weather. But because of my own interests, I have always tended to study the patterns themselves as phenomena, rather than for what they represented.
Rini felt Martine stiffen in the chair beside her, but she could see nothing but the same confused look on her companion's face.
In fact, Sellers continued, at first my interest in the patterns that have brought us to this place today were almost purely observational, just as a poet may examine the way water runs and splashes and pools without the practical interest of a plumber or physicist. I have long been fascinated with the way information itself moves, collects, and moves again. But even a poet may notice when the drain is blocked and the sink is beginning to overflow. I came to see that there were certain very large patterns of data flow that did not correspond to what I knew of the accepted map of the information sphere.
What does all this have to do with us? Demanded the woman who had entered with Cho'an Li. Her English was blandly unaccented. Rini wondered if she was hearing the effects of translation software. Sellers paused.
It is important you understand my journey, or you will not understand the reasons for your own. Please, hear me out. After that, if you wish, you may walk away and never think of this again.
You mean we're not prisoners? The woman asked. The blank space that was Sellers turned to Bolivar Atasco.
Prisoners? What have you told them?
Apparently some of the local police misunderstood my desire to have new arrivals brought here to the palace.
The God King said hurriedly,
I may have been a little unclear in my orders.
What a surprise,
said his wife.
No, none of you are prisoners.
Sellers was firm.
I know it cannot have been easy for any of you to come here.
Except me,
chirped Sweet William, fanning himself with his black-gloved hand. Rini could not stand it any longer.
Will you shut up? Why can't anyone here just listen? People are dead, others are dying, and I want to hear what this Sellers has to say.
She slapped her hand on the table and glared at Sweet William, who curled up in his chair like a wet spider, plumes and points quivering.
You win, Amazon Queen, he said, eyes wide in mock horror. I'll shut me gob.
It cannot have been easy for any of you to come here,
Sellers repeated.
It was certainly very difficult to gather you here, so I hope you will hear me out before making up your minds.
He stopped and took a deep, sighing breath. Rini was oddly touched. There was a living person behind the bizarre blank sim, somebody with fears and worries like anyone else.
As I said, I noticed unexplained patterns in the virtual universe some call the datasphere. Excessive activity in certain areas, particularly in the wholesale accessing of technical libraries, and the abrupt disappearance from their jobs of many top names in network and VR-related technologies. I began to examine these events more closely. Money, too, left its own trails, as stocks were sold unexpectedly, businesses suddenly liquidated, and other businesses founded. I discovered, after long research, that most of these activities were being controlled by a single group of people, although they had shielded their transactions so well that only luck and a certain talent for pattern recognition allowed me to find them and learn their names. These people wealthy and powerful men and women, were a consortium that called themselves the Grail Brotherhood.
Kind of Christian thing, suggested the robot goggle boy. Godhoppers!
I saw nothing particularly Christian in their activities, Sellers said. They were spending incalculable amounts of money on technology, apparently building something. What that something was, I could not discover. But I had a great deal of time on my hands, and my curiosity was aroused. I pursued this investigation for a number of years, growing ever more uneasy. It seemed unlikely that anyone would put as much effort and expense into something as the Brotherhood had, and still keep it secret. At first I had assumed that the project was a long-term business, being built from the ground up, but after a while, the sheer amount of money and time dumped into this invisible resource began to make that seem unlikely. How could this Brotherhood spend unaccountable billions on something? The resources of entire family fortunes, for a lifetime's hoarding by many of the world's richest people, poured down a metaphorical hole for 2 decades, earning nothing, and still hope to make a profit. What business could possibly be worth that sort of investment? I considered other goals the Brotherhood might have, some of them as extreme as any of the most lurid net entertainments. The overthrow of governments. These people already overthrew governments as easily as an average person might change jobs or wardrobes. World conquest? Why, these people already had everything a human could want. Unimaginable luxury and power. One of the Brotherhood, the financier Jun Bao, ranked on his personal income, is the 15th richest country in the world.
Jun Bao!
Chuan Li was horrified.
He is one of the men who has done this to my granddaughter?
She rocked fretfully in her chair.
They call him emperor. The Chinese government does nothing without his approval.
Sellers inclined his head.
Just so. But why would such people wish to do anything to upset the balance of world power? I asked myself. They are world power. So what were they doing? And why were they doing it?
And?
Asked Sweet William.
I'll do the drum roll, Chuck. The answer is...
There are still more questions than answers, I fear. When I began to encounter rumors of something called the Other Land, supposedly the world's largest and most powerful simulation network, I understood the what at last. But the why, it is still a mystery.
Saying this some Tabnet-like conspiracy?
Asked the Chrome Battle Robot.
Space aliens something? Far scanning you.
It is indeed that,
Sellers replied.
A conspiracy. If it were not, why was such an immense exercise kept secret? But if you think I am merely an alarmist, consider the factor that I know has brought most of you here. The Brotherhood has an unusual interest in children.
He paused, but now the room was silent. Even Atasco and his wife were raptly attentive.
Once I knew who to watch. Once I began to discover the names of Otherland's secret masters, I could hunt for more specific kinds of information. I discovered that several of the organization's key members have an exceptional interest in children, but one that seems to go bizarrely farther than even pedophilia. Based on the quantities of medical and sociological research they have sponsored, the number of pediatric specialists who briefly occupied the payrolls of companies linked to the Brotherhood, the number of youth-oriented facilities, adoption agencies, sports clubs, interactive networks, which were founded or brought up by Brotherhood-related front organizations, This interest is clearly professional, all-encompassing, and frighteningly inexplicable.
Mr. Jays, Reaney muttered. The bastards.
Exactly.
Sellers nodded his uppermost blank space.
I apologize, he said. I am taking longer than I wished to explain this.
He rubbed at the place where his forehead would be.
I have thought about this so long, and now I find there is so much to tell.
But what could they want with these children?
Asked Cho'an Li.
I am sure that you are right, but what do they want?
Sellers lifted his hands.
I wish I knew. The Grail Brotherhood has built the most powerful, sophisticated simulation network imaginable. At the same time, they have manipulated and injured the minds of thousands of children. I still have no idea why. In fact, I summoned you here, all of you, in hopes that together we might discover some answers.
You put on a good show, Ducky, said Sweet William cheerfully. And I admire the little touches very much, although the preventing me from going offline bit is rapidly losing its charm. Why don't you just take your strange little story to the news nets instead of involving us in all this cloak and dagger?
I tried, in the early days, to do what you suggest. Two reporters and three researchers were killed. The news nets broadcast nothing. I am only here to speak to you because I had kept myself anonymous.
Sellers paused for another long breath.
I am shamed by those deaths, but they taught me that this is not a mere obsession on my part. This is a war.
He turned, surveying all the faces at the table.
The members of the Brotherhood are too powerful and too well connected, but my attempt to interest others in an investigation did bring me one huge piece of luck. One of the researchers found and contacted Bolivar Atasco and his wife, Silviana. Although they refused to answer the researcher's questions, the way in which they refused interested me, and I followed up on my own. I was not immediately successful.
We thought you were a madman,
said Silviana Atasco dryly.
I still think that is possible, senor.
Sellers bowed his shapeless blank head.
Fortunately for us all, the Atascos, who were among the earliest members of the Grail Brotherhood, had fallen away from the central body and left the board of directors several years before. They retained their investment in the form of this simulation, Temelun, but otherwise had nothing to do with the day-to-day affairs of the consortium. Senor, Senora, perhaps you would like to tell a little of your experiences?
Bolivar Atasco started. He seemed to have been thinking of something else. He looked helplessly to his wife, who rolled her eyes.
It is simple, she said. We needed a more sophisticated simulation engine for our work. We had gone as far as possible with existing technology. We were approached by a group of wealthy men. There were no women in the group then, who had heard of our early versions of Temelun, created with what was then the state-of-the-art technology. They were planning to build the most comprehensive simulation platform ever conceived, and they brought us in to help supervise the construction of that platform. She curled her lip. I never liked them.
She might make a better god-king than her husband, Reaney decided.
They wouldn't let me do my job properly,
Bolivar Atasco added.
I mean to say, there are totally unknown factors of complexity in something this large and rapid. But when I tried to ask questions, when I tried to find out why some things were being done in the peculiar way the Brotherhood had chosen, I was interfered with. So I gave them my resignation.
That is all?
The woman with the translator accent sounded furious.
You just said I don't approve and resigned, but hung on to your big playground? How dare you speak like that to us?
Silviana Atasco demanded.
All of this,
these things of which Sellers speaks, her husband waved his hands in vaguely all-encompassing circles, we knew nothing of them. When Sellers came to us, that was the first time we heard.
Please,
Sellers gestured for quiet.
As the Otoscos say, they were unaware. You can judge them harshly if you wish, but we are here by their permission, so perhaps it would be better to hold that judgment until you have all the facts.
The woman who had spoken sat back, tight-lipped.
To hurry through what has already gone on too long for one sitting, I approached the Otoscos.
Sellers continued.
After much effort, I was able to convince them that there were things about the Grail Brotherhood and other land they did not know. Using their access to the network, I was able to do some further investigating. Only a little, however, because I dared not attract attention either to the Otoscos or myself. It quickly became clear to me that I could not hope to achieve anything working alone. Still, I could not bear to send more people to their deaths. I cannot overemphasize the power of the Brotherhood. They have immense holdings in all parts of the world. They control, or at least influence, armies and police forces and governmental bodies in all the world's states. They killed those researchers as swiftly as a man swats a fly, and paid no more penalty for it than that man would. Who would join me against such enemies, and how could I contact them? The answer came fairly easily, at least to the first question. Those who had suffered at these people's hands would wish to help. Those who had lost friends and loved ones to the Brotherhood's inexplicable conspiracy. But I dared not put more innocents at risk, and I also needed people who would be able to bring skills to the struggle, because a shared concern alone would not be, will not be enough. So I conceived of a sort of task, like something from an ancient folk tale. Those who could find Temelun would be the ones who could help me unravel the schemes of the Brotherhood. I left clues, scattered seeds, floated out obscure messages in digital bottles. Many of you, for instance, received an image of the Otoscos' virtual city. I put these significators in obscure places, but always at the periphery of the Brotherhood's activities, so that those who had chosen on their own to investigate might stumble on them there. But I was forced to make these hints temporary and vague, in part to protect the Otoscos and myself. Those of you who have reached Temelun, whatever else you may decide about me and my hopes, be proud. You have solved a mystery where perhaps a thousand others have failed.
Sellers paused. Several of the listeners stirred.
Why can't we go offline?
Demanded the black-haired barbarian's friend.
That's the only mystery I want solved. I tried to unplug, and it was like being electrocuted. My real body's in a hospital somewhere, but I'm still jacked in.
This is the first I have heard of it.
Even over the murmuring of the guests, Sellers sounded surprised.
There are things at work in this place that none of us understand yet. I would never hold anyone against their will.
He raised his shapeless white hands.
I will try to find a solution.
You'd better!
And what was that thing?
Rini asked.
The thing that grabbed us, I don't know any other way to put it, when we were entering the simulation. It killed the man who got us here. Otoscos says it's a neural network, but Singh said it was alive.
Others at the table whispered among themselves.
I do not know the answer to that, either.
Sellers conceded,
there is a neural network at the center of Otherland. That much is true, but how it operates, and what alive might mean under the circumstances, are more undiscovered secrets of this place. That is why I need your help.
Help? You need help, all right.
Sweet William stood, plumes wagging, and sketched an elaborate and mocking bow.
"Darlings, my patience has just about gone. I am going bye-bye now. I shall climb into bed with something warm and do my best to forget I heard any of this nonsense."
"But you can't."
The brawny, long-haired man with the action-flick muscles got shakily to his feet. His voice was deep, but his way of speaking seemed incongruous.
"Don't you understand? Don't any of you understand? This is the Council of Elrond."
The painted mouth pursed in a grimace.
"What are you rattling on about?"
"Don't you know Tolkien? I mean, this is it. One ring to rule them all. One ring to find them."
The barbarian seemed to be getting worked up. Rini, who had been about to say something sharp to Sweet William herself, swallowed her annoyance and watched. There was something almost crazy in the man's excitement, and for a moment Rini wondered if he might be mentally unbalanced.
"Ah, what of those sort of stories?"
Sweet William said disdainfully.
"I was wondering about that Mr. Muscle look of yours."
"You are Orlando, yes?"
Sellers sounded gently pleased.
"Or should it be Thargor?"
The barbarian did a surprised double-take.
"Orlando, I guess. I didn't choose the Thargor body, really. Not for this. It happened when we came here."
"That's where I've seen him," Rini whispered to Khabu. "Treehouse. Remember? The human breakfast hated his sim."
"I am glad you are here, Orlando."
Sellers again was grave.
"I hope the others will come to share your beliefs."
"Share scan, that's truth," said the chrome-plated goggle boy. "He crash, you crash, me deftly flying."
He stood up, spiky fists on spiky hips, like a grumpy metal porcupine. Orlando would not be discouraged.
"Don't leave. This is how it always works. People who seem to have no hope, but each has something to give. Together they solve the mystery and conquer the enemy."
"A group of hopeless idiots all banding together to solve a seemingly impossible task. Is that it?"
Sweet William was scornfully amused.
"Yes, indeed. That sounds just like the kind of story you must like, sweetie. But it's just as good a description of a paranoid religious cult. Oh, no. Only we clever few understand that the world is coming to an end. But if we move into these storm drains and wear our special aluminum foil hats, we alone will be saved. Spare me that sort of drama, please. I suppose now you'll all take turns telling your pathetic life stories."
He drooped a hand across his brow, as though it were all too much to bear.
"Well, darlings, you can finish your little mad tea party without me. Will someone just shut off whatever bit of silliness is interfering with my command interface?"
Bolivar Atasco suddenly jerked upright in his seat, then stood and took a few staggering steps. Rini thought he had been offended by the foppish Sweet William, but Atasco froze in place, hands out as if to balance himself. There was a long instant of expectant silence.
"He seems to have dropped offline for a moment,"
Sellers said.
"Perhaps..."
Martine began to shriek. She clapped her hands against her head and tumbled to her knees, keening like a toxic spill alarm.
"What is it?" Rini cried. "Martine, what's wrong?"
Silviana Atasco had gone as motionless as her husband. Sellers stared at her, then at Martine, then vanished like a popped bubble. With Khabu's help, Rini hauled the Frenchwoman up into a chair, trying to find out what had gone wrong. Martine stopped shrieking, but could only moan as she swayed from side to side. The gathering had flown apart into anxious confusion. Khabu was speaking rapidly but quietly into Martine's ear. Chuan Li was asking Rini if she could help. The goggle boy and Sweet William were arguing violently. Sellers was gone. The motionless forms of the Atascos still stood at the head of the table. Except now, Bolivar Atasco was moving.
"Look!"
Rini cried, pointing. The feather-crowned figure stretched its arms out to their full extension, fingers flexing convulsively. It took a staggering step, then braced itself against the table as awkwardly as a blind man. The head sank onto the chest. The guests fell silent as everyone turned to watch Atasco. The head came up again.
I hope none of you think you're going anywhere.
It was not Atasco's voice, but someone else's entirely. The vowels broad and flat, the words without warmth. Even the facial expression was subtly different.
Trying to leave would be a very bad idea.
The thing wearing Atasco's sim turned to the frozen form of Silviana Atasco. It gave a casual shove, and her sim tumbled out of the chair and landed on the stone floor, still stiffly holding its sitting position.
I'm afraid the Atascos have left early, said the cold voice. But don't worry. We'll think of ways to keep the party entertaining.
Chapter 36 The Singing Harp. Netfeed, personals. Wanted, conversation. Visual, advertiser, MJ, standard A-sex sim. MJ, hey, just wanted to know if there's anyone out there. Anyone want to talk? I'm just feeling kinda, you know, lonely. Just thought there might be someone else out there feeling lonely too. He had hit his head, which made it hard to think of anything else. He was falling, the great canal heaving and spinning upward toward him. Then, through the pain and sparkling darkness, Paul felt things move sideways, a vast spasm that seemed to ripple through him and whip-crack him into fragments. For an instant, everything halted. Everything. The universe lay tipped at an impossible angle, the sky below him like a bowl of blue nothing, the red land and the water tilting away above his head. Galley hung frozen in the middle of the air, with his small body contorted and his hands outflung, one of them touching Paul's own fingers. Paul's other arm stretched above him toward the motionless canal, sunk to the wrist in the glassy water, a cuff of rigid splash stretching back along his forearm. It's all stopped, Paul thought. Suddenly, a great light burned through everything he could see, scorching it to nothingness. And he was falling again. One instant of darkness, another of fiery brilliance. Darkness, brilliance, darkness, becoming an ever-speeding stroboscopic alternation. He was falling through something, falling between. He could sense Galley somewhere just beyond reach, could feel the boy's terror, but was helpless to relieve it in any way. Then he was abruptly stationary again, down on his hands and knees on cold, hard stone. Paul looked up. A white wall stretched before him, empty but for a huge banner of red, black, and gold. A chalice sprouted twining roses. A crown hovered above them, the legend Ad Aeternum written below it in ornate characters.
I've been here before.
Although he only murmured, the slow, astonished words found little echoes up in the high ceiling. His eyes filled with tears. It was more than the banner, more than the growing sense of familiarity. There were other thoughts crowding in, images, sensations, things that fell onto the parched earth of his memory like a renewing rain. I'm Paul Jonas. I was born in Surrey. My father's name is Andrew. My mother's name is Nell, and she's very sick. Remembrance was taking root in what had been empty places, sprouting and flowering. A walk with his grandmother. Young Paul out of primary for the day and pretending to be a growling bear behind a hedge. His first bicycle, tire flat and rim bent, and the awful feeling of shame at having damaged it. His mother with her chemical respirator and her look of tired resignation. The way the moon hung framed in the branches of a budding plum tree outside his flat in London. Where am I? He examined the stark white walls, the banner with its strangely shifting colors. A new set of memories filtered up, sharp and bright and jagged as pieces of a broken mirror. A war that seemed to last for centuries. Mud and fear and a flight through strange lands, among strange people. And this place, too. He had been here before. Where have I been? How did I get here? Old memories and new were growing together, but in the midst there lay a scar, a barren place they could not cover. The confusion in his head was terrible, but most terrible of all was this blankness. He crouched and raised his hands to his face, covering his eyes as he struggled for clarity. What could have happened? His life had been ordinary. School, a few love affairs, too much time spent hanging about with friends who had more money than he did and could better afford the long drunken lunches and late nights. A not very hard-earned degree in, it took a moment, art history. A job as a bottom-level assistant curator at the Tate. Sober suit, wired collar, tour groups wanting to cluck over the new genocide installation. Nothing unusual. He was Paul Robert Jonas. He was all that he had. But that still didn't make him anything special. He was nobody. Why this? Insanity? A head injury? Could there be a madness this detailed, this placid? Not that all of it had been so quiet. He had seen monsters, horrible things. He remembered them just as clearly as he remembered the clothesline on the roof outside his university residence window. Monsters. Clanking, gnashing, steaming. Paul stood up, suddenly frightened. He had been in this place before, and something terrible lived here. Unless he was locked in some incomprehensible kind of false memory, a déjà vu with teeth in it, he had been here, and this was not a safe place.
Paul!
The voice was faint, far away, and thin with desperation. But he knew it even before he knew which part of his life it came from. Galley? The boy. The boy had been with him when they had fallen from that flying ship. But Paul had let that knowledge slip away in the rush of returning memory. And now? Was the child being stalked by that huge, impossible thing, the machine giant? Galley! Where are you? No answer. He forced himself to his feet and hurried toward the door at the far end of the hall. On the far side, another imposition of reality and memory, almost painfully potent. Dusty plants stretched out in all directions, reaching toward the roof beams, all but covering the high windows. He was lost in an indoor jungle. Beyond, he knew, he remembered, there was a giant. And a woman, a heartbreakingly beautiful woman with wings.
Paul! Help!
He lurched toward the boy's voice, pushing at the dry, rubbery branches. Leaves came apart in his hands, turning to powder and joining the dust that drifted and swirled at his every movement. The thicket parted before him, the branches falling back, dropping away, some disintegrating at his touch to reveal a cage of slender golden bars. The bars were mottled with black and gray smears, and dark tendrils wound through them. The cage was empty. Despite his fear for the boy, Paul felt a shock of disappointment. This was the place she had been. He remembered her vividly, the shimmer of her wings, her eyes. But now the cage was empty. No, almost empty. In the middle, nearly covered by a tangle of vines and roots and the mulch of fallen leaves, something glimmered. Paul crouched and pushed his arm through the tarnished bars, straining to reach the center. His hand closed around something smooth and cool and heavy. As he lifted it and pulled it back through the bars, a string of chiming notes sounded in the air. It was a harp, a curving golden loop with golden strings. As he held it before him and stared, it warmed beneath his fingers, then began to shrink, curling like a leaf on a bonfire. Within a few moments, it had become as tiny as a 20-pence coin.
Paul! I can't...
The cry of pain that followed was sharp and sudden in its ending. He stood, startled into trembling, then curled the golden thing in his fist and began to smash his way through the crumbling vegetation. He had gone only a few steps when a door loomed before him, 5 times his own height. He touched it, and it swung inward. The massive, hangar-sized room beyond had timbered beams and walls of piled, undressed stone. Huge wheels turned slowly. Great levers pumped up and down. Gears the size of a double-decker bus chewed their way around the circuit of even larger gears, whose full extent was hidden, but whose toothed rims pushed in through vast slots in the walls. The place smelled like oil and lightning and rust, and sounded like slow destruction. The noise, the deep, steady ratcheting that vibrated the massive walls, the monotonous hammer-thump of great weights falling, was the song of an incomprehensible, unceasing hunger, of machinery that could gnaw away even the foundations of time and space. Galley stood in the one clear space at the center of the room. 2 figures flanked him, one thin, the other immensely fat. A despairing darkness settled behind Paul's eyes as he walked forward. Galley struggled, but the two held him without effort. The slender one was all shiny metal,
claw-handed, inhuman, with an eyeless head like a piston. Its companion was so fat that his oily skin was stretched almost to transparency, glowing with a suety yellow-gray light of its own, like a massive bruise. The big one's broken tusked mouth spread in a smile whose corners disappeared into the doughy cheeks.
"You've come back to us, all the way back, and of your own free will."
It laughed, and the cheeks jiggled.
"Imagine that, Nickel Plate. How he must have missed us. It's too bad the old man isn't here to enjoy this moment."
"Only right that the Jonas should come back," the metallic one said,
an inner door opening and shutting in its rectangular mouth.
"He should be sorry, too, after all the considerable bother he's given us, the naughty fellow. He should beg us to forgive him. Beg us."
"Let the boy go." Paul had never seen the pair before, but he knew them as well and hated them as powerfully as the cancer that had slowly killed his mother. "It's me you want."
"Oh, goodness. It's not just you we want anymore,"
the metal creature said.
"Is it, Butterball?"
The fat one shook its head.
"First, give us what's in your hand. We'll trade that for the boy."
End of side 22. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 23. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 713. Paul felt the hard edges of the harp against the skin of his fingers. Why did they want to bargain? Here, in this place of their power, why should they bother?
"Don't do it!"
Callie shouted.
"They can't!"
The thing called Butterball tightened slug-like fingers on his arm, and the boy began to writhe and shriek, twitching as though he had fallen onto an electrified rail track.
"Give it to us,"
said Nickelplate.
"And then, perhaps, the old man will be kind. Things were good for you once, Paul Jonas. They could be good again."
Paul could not bear to look at Galley's gaping mouth, agonized eyes. "Where's the woman? There was a woman in that cage." Nickelplate turned a near featureless face to regard Butterball for a long, silent moment, then turned back.
"Gone. Flown. But not far. Not for long. Do you want to see her again? That can be arranged."
Paul shook his head. He knew these things could never be trusted. "Just let the boy go."
"Not until you give us what's in your hand."
Butterball made Galley convulse again. Horrified, Paul held out the harp. Both faces, chrome and candle wax, turned greedily toward it. The room shuddered. For a moment, Paul thought the massive machinery had begun to break down. Then, as the walls themselves seemed to shred, he had a sudden and greater fear. The old man? But Nickelplate and Butterball were also staring, mouths open, as the very planes of geometric form began to slide apart around them. Paul was still standing with his hand outstretched, and Nickelplate abruptly took an impossibly long stride toward him, shining claw scrabbling for the harp. Galley, who had slumped to the floor, curled his arms around Nickelplate's shiny legs, and the creature stumbled and fell with a sound of metal scraping on stone. The room and Paul and everything shuddered again, then fell apart and curled in on itself. He was frozen in midair above the sky once more, and the great canal and red desert again arched above his head. But the air was now empty, where Galley had hung beside him. Where Galley had touched his outstretched fingers, his own hand was now closed in a fist. Even as his bedeviled mind tried to grasp the abrupt transition from the giant's gearhouse back to this perfect stasis, the world surged into life. Colors came unstuck and ran. Solids became air, and the air became water, swallowing Paul with a great, cold slurp. He floundered, his lungs full to bursting, but beginning to ache. The wet blackness around him was chill and heavy. He could make no sense of up or down. He saw a dim glow, a yellow that might be sunlight, and heaved toward it, wriggling like an eel. For a moment, the light surrounded him. Then he was in blackness again. But this time, the cold was murderous. He saw light again, a cooler blue, and fought toward it. As he rose, he could see the slender tips of dark trees and gray clouded sky.
Then his hand struck and bounced back. He kicked, thrusting his face up toward the light, scrabbling with his fingers. But something solid lay between him and the air, prisoning him in the freezing water. Ice! He smashed at it with his fists, but could not make even a crack. His lungs were filled with burning coals, his head with smothering shadows, drowning, somewhere, somehow, and never to know why. The knowledge will die with me, about the Grail. The meaningless thought flitted through his deepening personal darkness like a shiny fish. The water was sucking all heat from his body. He could not feel his legs. He pressed his face up against the ice, praying for a pocket of air, but a tiny breath brought him only more wet coldness. It was useless to fight any longer. He opened his mouth to take in the water that would end his pain, then paused for a last instant to try to focus on the glimpse of sky. Something dark covered the hole, and in that same moment the ice and the sky and the clouds crashed down at him, shoving him back and startling the air out of his straining body. He gasped reflexively, and water rushed in, filling him, choking him, obliterating him. A curtain wavered, a fluttering screen of orange and yellow. He tried to focus on it, but could not. No matter how intently he stared, it would not take on resolution, but remained soft and without texture. He closed his eyes, resting for a moment, then opened them and tried again. He could sense something touching him, but it was an oddly detached feeling, as though his body were impossibly long, and the ministrations were being performed on a very distant section. He wondered if he had been, he could not remember the word, but found instead an image of a hospital room, the smell of alcohol, a sharp small pain like an insect sting, anesthetized. But why would they? He had been the river. He tried to sit up, but could not. The delicate ministrations, so soft, so distant, continued. He focused his eyes again and realized at last that he was staring at the shifting flames of a fire. His head seemed to be connected to his body by only a few nerves. He could feel something beneath him, and could tell that the surface was rough and uncomfortable, but his body was numb, and the discomfort was purely speculative. He tried to speak, but could only make a faint gasping noise. As if summoned, a face floated into view, perpendicular to his line of sight. It was bearded and heavy-browed. The brown eyes, deep in the shadowed sockets, were round as an owl's.
"You are cold," the face said.
The voice deep and calm.
"Dying cold. We will warm you."
The face slid out of his sight once more. Paul collected what thoughts he could. He had survived again. So far, anyway. He remembered his name and everything that had returned to him as he knelt before the rose and chalice banner. But where he had been was still missing from his mind, and where he was now had become a fresh mystery. He tried to sit up and could not, but managed to roll onto his side. Feeling was beginning to return to his body, sprays of needle pricklings up and down his legs that were rapidly growing worse. He was alternately racked by shivers and spasms of pain. At least he could finally see beyond the curtain of fire, though it took a moment before he could make sense of what was before him. The one who had spoken, and half a dozen other bearded, shadow-eyed men, were crouched in a semicircle around the fire. A roof of stone stretched above them, but they were not in a cave so much as a deep overhang of rock in the side of a hill. Beyond the opening lay a world of almost perfect whiteness, a world of deep snow that stretched all the way to a line of saw-toothed mountains in the distance. At the base of the hillside, perhaps a half-mile away, he could see the thin gray shape of the frozen river and the black hole out of which these men had pulled him. He looked down. The one who had spoken was cutting Paul's wet clothes away with a piece of black stone that had been chipped into the shape of a leaf. He was powerfully built, with broad hands and flat fingers. His own clothing was a ragtag assortment of animal skins, tied in place with cords of sinew.
Neanderthals,
Paul thought.
They're cavemen, and this is the Ice Age or something. It's like a bloody museum exhibit, except I'm living in it, 50,000 years away from anything I know.
A horrible ache coursed through him. He was alive, but somehow he had lost his life, his real life, and was apparently doomed to wander permanently through some horrible labyrinth without ever knowing why. Tears welled up in his eyes and ran down his cheeks. Even the shivering and the pain in his awakening nerves fell away.
overmatched by the anguish of total loss. Gali is gone. Vala is gone. My family, my world, everything gone.
He rolled his face against the stone, brought up one hand to hide himself from the eyes of the staring bearded men, and wept. By the time the stone knife tore through the last piece of his shirt, Paul could sit up. He dragged himself a few inches nearer to the fire. Another of his rescuers handed him a great fur-covered skin that stank of fat and smoke, and he gratefully wrapped himself in it. His shivering gradually subsided to a faint but continuous tremor. The one with the knife picked up Paul's ruined clothing, which was stiff with ice, and set the pile to one side with a certain anxious care. As he did, something clicked against the stone and rolled free, glinting. Paul stared, then picked it up, turning it over in his hand, watching firelight spark from the golden facets.
"We saw you in the water," the knife-wielder said. "We thought you were an animal, but Birdcatcher saw you were not an animal. We pulled you from the water."
Paul closed his fingers around the gem-like object. It warmed. Then a gentle voice filled the cavern, making him jump.
"If you have found this, then you have escaped,"
it said. Paul looked around, afraid his rescuers would be terrified, but they were still looking at him with the same slightly worried reserve. After a moment, he realized they could not hear the voice, that it spoke to him alone.
"Know this," it said. "You were a prisoner. You are not in the world in which you were born. Nothing around you is true. And yet the things you see can hurt you or kill you. You are free, but you will be pursued, and I can help you only in your dreams. You must remain uncaptured until you find the others I am sending. They will look for you on the river. They will know you if you tell them the golden harp has spoken to you."
The voice went silent. When Paul opened his hand, the shining thing was gone.
"Are you a spirit of the river?"
the knife-wielder asked.
"Birdcatcher thinks you are a drowned man, returned from the land of the dead."
The land of the dead? Paul let his head sink to his chest. He felt exhaustion pressing on him, heavy as the stony hillside above them. His sudden laughter had a cracked sound, and the men shied back, grunting and whispering. More tears made his vision blur.
Land of the dead. That sounds about right.
Chapter 37. Johnny's Twist. Netfeed Sports. TMX makes Olympic goodwill gesture. Visual. TMX Olympic flag rippling over Athenaeum, Bucharest. VO. Telemorphics Incorporated has made what it calls a goodwill gesture to resolve its dispute with the International Olympic Committee and the government of the Wallachian Republic. Instead of the Telemorphics Bucharest Olympic Games, as the corporation had initially insisted the event be known, the official name will be the Bucharest Olympic Games, sponsored by Telemorphics. Visual, TMX VPPR, Natasha Sissonson. Sissonson, we respect the Olympic tradition of peaceful compromise, and we feel we've held out a major olive branch. However, the IOC should remember that nobody ever gets something for nothing. Not that I've heard about, anyway. The moon was only a fingernail sliver above the black Bahia de Barbacoas. The island, hedged by orange spotlights, glowed more brightly than anything in the sky. Dredd smiled. It was a nest full of jeweled eggs. And he was the predator. He would take those lights in his jaws and crush them into darkness. Dredd brought up the Exultate Jubilate, a piece of ancient music that throbbed like electricity and rang with joyful transcendence. He regretted using a piece of pre-programmed music, but he had too many things to do, and tonight there would be no time to build his own soundtrack as he acted out his starring role. Mozart would do well enough. He fingered his T-jack, wolfishly happy to be off the fiber-link leash. He lowered his hands to his knees, intensely aware of the resistant neoprene of his suit and the tiny grains of sand adhering to his palms, then closed his eyes so he could see the important things.
Track 1. Report.
A window containing a view of the choppy water from high above appeared against the blackness.
Listo, declared Track 1's foreman. Ready.
Track 2.
Another window.
filled by a dim shape which he recognized as a reflection-resistant boat only because he had purchased it himself. Before it, a group of shadowy figures lying prone on the sand. One of the figures moved slightly. Night goggles glinted.
Ready, Hefe.
Track 3.
A stack of equipment against the bad paint wall of a rented apartment. Each box finished in the irritating matte black that was experiencing a revival among trendy wareheads. Nothing else.
What the hell?
The pause lasted several seconds before a shaved head appeared, and Celestino's voice reverberated in the bones of Dredd's skull.
I was making a last-second adjustment, Hefe. I am now ready.
Having a last-second terror piss, more likely.
Dredd sent a closed sidebar call to the room next to the gear lab. A woman's face appeared, round and pale beneath flaming red hair.
Dulcie, what's up? Is he going to get it done?
He's an idiot, but he's competent, if you know what I mean. I'm here. Go ahead and light it up.
He was glad he had brought her in. Dulcinea Anwin was expensive, but not without reason. She was smart and efficient, and could have walked right through the Battle of Waterloo without blinking. For a brief moment, he wondered what kind of quarry she'd make. An interesting thought.
Track 4.
The observation center balcony, which he had occupied himself only a few hours ago, appeared against his closed eyelids. This man, unlike Celestino, was waiting for the call.
Ready to spike!
Dredd nodded. Although neither the heads in the data windows or the dozen other men with him on the dark beach could see his face, he opened his eyes and summoned up the sight map, allowing it to spread itself in a neon grid on top of the real Isla del Santuario, looming just a few kilometers away. Perfect. Everything in place.
Action.
He brought up the Exultate, and for a moment he was alone in the Caribbean night with the moon, the water, and the soprano's silvery voice.
Track 4. Spike it.
The man in the beach house keyed up a security code, then spoke a word into his throat mic. At this signal, Dredd's contact at ENT Inravision injected the program he had been supplied into the Cartagena telecom net, a simple, although criminal, action for which the employee would receive 15,000 Swiss credits and an offshore bank account to go with it. The code sought out and connected with an unobtrusive resident parasite in the Isla de Santuario house system, a lurker which had been deposited for the sum of 40,000 by a disaffected employee of the previous security company during her last night on the job. Acting in concert, the two created a temporary data tap into the island's information system. Either the system itself or human oversight would be bound to spot the tap within 10 minutes or so. But Dredd did not need any longer than that.
This is 4. Spike is in.
The Mozart lifted him. Pleasure ran through him like cool fire, but he kept his elation to himself.
Good. Track 3, start pumping.
Celestino bobbed his head.
My pleasure, Hefe.
The gearman closed his eyes and swirled his fingers in a complicated pattern as he began to make the input-output connections. Dredd kept his voice calm.
Give me a link and a raise as soon as you have them.
He was developing what might be an irrational hatred of this poofting ex-military idiot. That was almost as bad as being too trusting. He closed his eyes again and watched the seconds tick off on the time display. Except for Celestino conducting his invisible orchestra of data, seeming to Dredd's jaundiced eye to mock the sublimity of the Exultate, the other windows were static, awaiting his orders. He took a moment to enjoy the sensation. On the rare occasions when they spoke about their work, some of the others in his very small field of expertise referred to what they did as art. Dredd thought that was self-aggrandizing bullshit. It was just work. Although at times like this it was exciting, satisfying, challenging work. But nothing this orderly and pre-planned could be called art. Now the chase, that was art. It was art of the moment, art of opportunity, art of courage and terror, and the blind, razoring edge of things. There was no comparison between the two. One was a job, the other was sex. You could be good at your job and proud of it, but no one would ever mistake the best of one for the transcendence of the other. Celestino was in the bones of his ears again.
The pumping station is up and running, Hefe. Do you want a line into the security net?
Of course I bloody well do. Jesus. Track one, report.
Track one's window showed more black water. This time from higher up. 15 kilometers away and closing.
Stand by for my call.
A moment more, and the music began to swell toward crescendo. An array of tiny windows blinked on at the periphery of his vision.
Track three. Which one's the broadcasting channel?
Second from the left, Celestino answered. Currently quiet.
Dredd brought it up and checked. Not because he thought the gear man was that incompetent, but because he was in that singular high-flying and godlike mode. He wanted every spark, every falling leaf at his fingertips and under his control. As Celestino had said, there was only silence on the channel.
Track one, go.
The silence lasted for a few more moments. Then he heard the crackle of a radio in his ear. To make sure, he shut off the volume of his own line to track one, but he could still hear it coming in over the Isla del Santuario's security channel. He was listening with the target's own ears.
Mayday! Santuario, can you hear me?
There was a brief lag between the supposed pilot's Spanish and Dredd's system's translation, but he was already pleased. Under a professionally macho veneer, the actor sounded quite believably panicky. The Baenas had made a good choice.
Santuario, can you read me? This is XA-1339 out of Sincelejo. Mayday! Can you hear me?
This is Santuario, XA-1339. We have you on radar. You are too close. Please turn east and move out of our exclusion zone.
Dredd nodded. Polite, but fast and firm. The island's new security firm was worth the money.
We have lost our tail rotor. Santuario, can you hear me? We have lost our tail rotor. Requesting permission to land.
The pause was only a brief one.
Not possible. This is an exclusion zone, approved under the UN Aviation Act. Suggest you try for Cartagena, either the civil or heliport. It's only about 5 kilometers.
The captain's scream of rage was most convincing. Dredd could not help laughing.
You bastards! I'm going down! I can't make Cartagena! I have 4 passengers and 2 crew, and I can barely keep this thing in the air!
The Isla del Santuario continued not to live up to its name.
I apologize, XA-1339, but that is against my express orders. Repeat, against my express orders. Suggest again you try for Cartagena. If you attempt to land here, we will be forced to treat you as an attacking force. Do you copy?
The pilot's voice, when it came again, was flat and bitter. The loud noises that squelched some of his words sounded quite distinctly like a turboprop helicopter shaking itself apart.
I can't fight. Damn rotor. Can't any longer. We're going down. I'll try not crash on your precious island. I hope rot in hell.
Another urgent Spanish-speaking voice came on. Dredd checked the blinking lights, assuring himself that this was one of Island Security's sidebar channels.
Visual contact, sir. The rear rotor is damaged, just like he said. It's getting very near the water, moving erratically. They may go down on the rocks. Oh, my God, there they go.
From a great distance away across the dark water came a dull clank, like a mallet striking a held gong. Dredd smiled.
They've gone down within our perimeter, sir. The helicopter didn't catch fire, so there may be survivors. But the destroyer subs will be on them in a couple of minutes.
Shit. Are you sure they're in our zone, Ojeda?
The commanding officer of Island Security obviously didn't like being put in this situation.
I can see the helicopter, sir. It's still hanging on the rocks. But with the waves, it won't stay there long.
The officer brought up the first pictures from the camera drones, and when he saw his observer's words confirmed, cursed again. Dredd thought he knew just what was going through the man's mind. There had been security on this island for 20 years, even though his own employers had only gained the contract recently. 20 years, and nothing more dangerous than a few local fishermen threatening to stray into the exclusion zone had ever happened. He had just denied landing rights, however legally, to an aircraft in distress. Could he stretch that legality to this screaming point and let any of the helicopter survivors be killed by the submarine security drones as well? And, probably more tellingly, could he do it in front of his men and hope to keep their respect for a real security emergency?
Son of a whore!
He had wrestled it almost to the point where action would be too late.
Blind the subs! Shut down the whole marine hunter-killer grid! Yape? Get a boat out there as quick as possible to look for survivors. I'll call the boss and tell him what we're doing.
Hook, line, and sinker.
Dredd jumped up. Track two, launch. He waved to his own half of the invasionary force, a dozen men in neoprene commando suits. By the time he had finished his gesture, they were already running the boat into the water. He sprinted after them. His own work had just begun. The boat slid silently across the bay, slithering carefully through the dormant mines. Their search-and-destroy responses had been turned off, but that didn't mean one might not explode on accidental contact. Dredd sat in the back, happy for once to let someone else take charge. He had more